It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk about some of the biggest issues facing Native communities in Wisconsin during our discussion of today's State of the Tribes address.
First, the United States Supreme Court heard oral arguments this week in a case that could determine the ultimate future of the Affordable Care Act. At issue here are subsidies and whether Congress intended for the Federal Health Insurance Exchange to offer the same subsidies as the state exchanges.
If the court rules against the government, it could spell serious trouble for the health care law and the nearly 12 million people who've signed up for coverage under it. More specifically, what could it mean for Wisconsin, a state that opted against opening a state exchange?
Tom Oliver joins us now. He's a professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison and the director of UW's Master of Public Health program. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Well, there's a lot of Affordable Care Act out there. This case focuses on the subsidies part. What exactly is being challenged here?
Well, what's being challenged by Mr. King, the lead plaintiff, is that he's actually harmed because of subsidies that would make health insurance affordable for people with income at his level. He's arguing that without the subsidies, the insurance premiums would be considered unaffordable, meaning about 8.5% of his income or more, and he would not be required to purchase coverage at all. So it's a very backwards kind of logic here that he's actually being harmed because of something that would help him get health insurance.
Who would be affected if the Supreme Court rules in the plaintiff's favor and ends a particular group of subsidies under the Affordable Care Act?
Well, there's about 8 to 9 million people who have purchased insurance coverage in states that do not have exchanges that they set up themselves. In other words, their state, 34 states, have elected to let the federal government set up an exchange in their state. And so all of those who have purchased insurance and qualify for the subsidies in those states would be affected. So I think it's about 8 to 9 million people. And it's about 183,000 people right here in Wisconsin, which is about 4% of the population that is not eligible for Medicare.
So what would that mean for, say, a Wisconsinite who's right now signed up, right now receiving subsidies? What do we know about what would happen to them if the court ruled against the Affordable Care Act here?
Well, they'd have a few options. The first is obviously to purchase the insurance with no financial assistance whatsoever, which would be a huge barrier for most people, as you know. It's many thousands of dollars for individuals and even more than that for family coverage. The second thing would be to go back to their employer and see if there's coverage available through the employer. But the reason most people came to the insurance exchanges in the first place is that there's not an affordable insurance option through their place of work.
And if someone's in a state that has its own exchange, this is a non-issue for them right now. Is that right?
Exactly. And so there's talk of two different sets of states that, and so it's really a big issue as to why this came up in the first place. And the entire thing is a really curious and mysterious kind of situation because, first of all, just to go back, the Circuit Court of Appeals voted unanimously to reject the plaintiff's claims and upheld the subsidies for residents in every state. So it's a mysterious situation where four justices on the Supreme Court elected to take the case, which is why it's hearing it in the first place. The other thing that's interesting is that Mr. King, the lead plaintiff, is reportedly a Vietnam veteran, and he apparently qualifies for health care coverage through the VA and isn't even required to buy his own insurance through an exchange set up under the Affordable Care Act. So whether he is even eligible to have brought the case in the first place is a big question. And then the other, you know, more important thing is in years and years leading up to, during and after the Affordable Care Act being passed in Congress and being implemented, there is not a hint in the testimony, the congressional debates, or congressional reports by nonpartisan agencies that residents that did not set up insurance exchanges, residents in those states would not qualify for the same financial assistance as residents in the states that did set up their own exchanges. So, you know, in the real world of legislative activity in most of the decades and centuries leading up to today, Congress would have fixed this in about 2 minutes by clarifying and confirming its intent. But right now we're stuck with the Supreme Court looking at four or five words buried way inside the Affordable Care Act and deciding if that means something that is critical to the lives of millions of people across the country and hundreds of thousands right here in Wisconsin. I mean, we're talking about all the residents of Eau Claire and all the residents of Green Bay basically being told you have no health care coverage. That's, you know, that you can't buy entirely on your own.
At the state level, is there anything Wisconsin could do either in anticipation of this ruling or after it came down to prepare for the end of those subsidies?
Well, first of all, the question is, if the Supreme Court rejects, you know, accepts the language on its face that said that the exchange not established by the state as opposed to those or an exchange established by the federal government on behalf of a state. If that was turned down and those subsidies weren't available, the Supreme Court could put a delay in effect and say you have X amount of time for the states to set up their own exchanges and conform with the law as interpreted. It could obviously, an awful lot of states who never once thought that they were making that kind of a major decision on behalf of their residents would probably kick into gear and go ahead and set up their own exchanges in order to gain access to those subsidies for their residents. But presumably not all states would choose to do that. The other problem is state legislatures usually meet for only a few months each year. And so if the Supreme Court in June makes that kind of a decision, it would be till next January before most state legislatures would even be back in operation to do this. And it's a question of whether a lot of state legislatures would come back into special session in the interim to set up and pass something that would require the government administratively to set up these exchanges.
So if the Supreme Court, rules against the White House here, overturns this part of the Affordable Care Act, how big a blow is that to Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act?
Well, it's significant only because it really is the thing that the subsidies are the thing that go along with requiring people to buy insurance. So if you're going to mandate that people buy insurance and participate in the pool on the grounds that someday they'll get sick and they'll need this insurance and they ought to participate now and not wait until they get sick. Without those subsidies, it's not really a tenable argument. And it's only a small portion of the entire insurance market, but it's a key one for individuals who otherwise can't get insurance through their place of work or retirement or some other kind of option. And so when these individual insurance markets have had to survive on their own in the past, only a few pretty wealthy people can really afford the premiums over the long haul, and anyone who really needs it but only has a modest income can't afford it, and the marketplace really falls apart. And so that was the experience in the 1980s and 90s and early 2000s. And so this is really fixing a well-understood problem, and it would be, you know, pretty tragic for a lot of people if they can't get access to insurance coverage buying it with hundreds of thousands of other people instead of having to buy it on their own.
Briefly, as we wrap up, this is not the first legal challenge, but if this one fails, the Supreme Court rules that the subsidies stay, do you see any other likely challenges that could derail the law, or is this kind of the last resort?
Well, the thing about this law is that it's been a major partisan battle for all ever since it was contemplated. Not a single Republican voted for it when it was passed in Congress, and not a single Republican today would vote for it from all appearances. So it really is a question for the 2016 election and what happens in the in the presidency, if there's someone in the White House who is also opposed to the Affordable Care Act, and in the U.S. Senate, where 60 votes would allow passage along with a majority in the House of Representatives to repeal the act in part or in whole. The question between now and then is whether people will come to value the act so much that it would become politically unviable to pull it back and get rid of it.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob.
That was Tom Oliver, professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison, talking about this latest Supreme Court legal challenge to the Affordable Care Act. First, a look at today's State of the Tribes address delivered earlier this afternoon. The address is a way for tribes from around the state to come together, celebrate progress they've made in the past year, and highlight challenges ahead.
Brandon Tomes is here. He's the public relations coordinator for the Chippewa Federation. Brandon, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
Well, this year, the State of the Tribes address was delivered by Chris McGeejik, chairman of the Sakagan Chippewa community. How was he chosen?
Well, generally speaking, it's on a rotating basis, so each year each tribe will have the opportunity to host and actually have their chairperson or their designee deliver that speech. So his name was up, Molik was on deck, and he did it.
Now, there was a lot going on at the Capitol today besides
yes.
State of the Tribes. Right to work, legislation being debated in the assembly. Did you feel that the address that was given got the attention that it was looking for?
Absolutely. And I actually think that, you know, there was a great deal of respect that was paid to the Indians and the tribal people that showed up because of the organizations that were already there. When we got there, they actually were very respectful and actually saluted the tribes and cheered for them. So I thought that was really great.
Now, in his speech, Chairman McGeejik laid out some key areas where he sees improvement needed for higher quality of life for Native Americans in Wisconsin. Is there a consensus among Wisconsin tribes about the challenges ahead?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are so many, shared instances of needs on each reservation that's what draws us as Indian people close together, because we all share in those, you know, those needs and the things that we want for our children. They're no different than the people of Wisconsin, and we are those people. So it's a general consensus among the tribes that, you know, the speech is delivered in a way that it's given by basically all the tribes. All the tribes have input. We just have Chairman McGeejik this year delivering it.
And one of the issues that came up was unregulated gaming. Now, first off, can you explain what that is?
Well, as you may or may not know, tribes, in order to have a casino or a gaming operation, they sign a compact with the state. So in that compact, there are rules that the tribes have to abide by, and likewise, the state abides by certain conditions of those compacts. So in those compacts, each tribe is guaranteed the right and the privilege to have the gaming operations where they are located. Also in there is the fact that there's no mention of unregulated gaming in those compacts. However, if you look outside of the reservations, there are numerous instances of a violating of those compacts when you have taverns that have gaming machines in them. And it's even expanded beyond the taverns to gas stations, laundromats. And we feel that those machines are unregulated, and they are diminishing the level of business that the tribes could be seeing right now. As you know, gaming is a highly regulated industry, and the tribes, you know, are put through a rigorous process to make sure that those protocols are met to ensure that the players are receiving a fair shake in the game, that the people delivering the games are, you know, on the up and up. So, it was mentioned, and I think that there needs to be a larger discussion on that topic.
Now, people who might be opposed to regulating those particular machines, the ones in taverns, might say, oh, there's just a few of those, maybe per area, per tavern, maybe one in a laundromat. How does such a small thing affect the tribes? Is it sort of a cumulative effect?
Yes, if we're talking about 25 to 30,000 of those machines, it's no longer a small thing. And, you know, estimates are about that. And, you know, again, I can't stress enough that, you know, the tribes, when they do anything, whether it's with the natural resources, gaming, business, what have you, when the tribes are endeavor to do things, they're put through a rigorous process, and our counterparts, our neighbors, aren't being held to that same standard. And I think that there needs, again, to be a larger conversation and really look at the taxation of those machines, the regulation. You know, one of our tribal council members in Lac des Flambeaux actually likes to share a story that his daughter, who was 10 years old, was able to play on one of those machines and win money. So that's a very good example of the unregulated nature of those machines and taverns and laundromats and all the other places we find them.
Well, and speaking of gaming, one controversial topic from this past year was the proposed Menominee Casino in Kenosha. Can you talk about how the fallout from that proposed casino may have affected the Native American population in Wisconsin?
Well, I think, at least from the Chippewa standpoint, is that, you know, they were very much behind the Menominee's effort to build that casino. You know, the Menominee are our relatives. They're brothers and sisters to us. And the issue with that is that, you know, Wisconsin is in such need of economic development and stimulated job growth that would have really brought a large industry to a downtrodden area of Kenosha. And we really feel that opportunity was lost, not only for the tribes, but for the entire portion of southern Wisconsin that, you know, would have benefited by having that establishment.
Has that caused any kind of schisms within the various tribes, or is it something that is being worked through and they're still...
I think the tribes are going through the process of communicating their frustration, and I think it's important that it's noted that they are communicating about it. There are discussions happening. The tribes know each other's position on issues such as that particular gaming establishment or proposed gaming establishment. And as long as they keep those lines of communication open, I think that it's not causing major rifts right now. But, you know, I think it kind of speaks to the old adage of divide and conquer. And I think that a little bit of that was in play here.
Now, one of the topics mentioned in that address today was the protection of tribal lands, specifically related to proposed mines in Wisconsin. And last week, news broke about Göbek Taconite closing its offices in Hurley. What have you heard in response to that news?
Well, what we've heard is that it's guarded optimism. And I've heard the word cautious optimism, guarded optimism. But the fact remains that as long as there are metals and materials in the earth that man wants and needs, the environment will always be at risk of harm to extract those elements. So there's just a guarded optimism that maybe this is going to quiet down for a little while, but by no means do the tribes believe that the threat of mining is over.
And what role do you think Native American tribes in Wisconsin should play in the decision about mines and other debates as they arise?
Well, that's a very easy one. They should be a central player in that decision process because of the fact that the northern two-thirds of the state are pretty much, you know, owned by the Chippewa Indians. And it's really sad when, you know, you have these agencies making these determinations without consulting with the tribes. I read somewhere last week that Governor Walker claimed to have over 1,000 meetings with the various tribes during his tenure as governor. And, you know, I don't know if a meeting is a phone call or if it's an email, but I can't see the 1,000 meetings where that number came from. So I really feel it's important that the tribes play a central role in those processes.
Now, education is an ongoing concern in Wisconsin. How are Native Americans in the state faring with the current education system, and what particular issues are you thinking about?
Well, when we're talking about education, we're talking about, first off, access to quality education, but more importantly, talking about having the culture and language reflected in tribal areas and across the state. And so, you know, our languages are dying. you know, there are fluent speakers of each of our languages in the state. However, we need to instill that in our children to make sure that our families are well grounded in who we are, in our culture. And I really think that the mascot issue, it was brought up, Chairman Mgijik brought that up, is something that really needs to be looked at further, because, you know, studies have proven that exposure to these negative, harmful images is you know, it dampers, it really challenges our tribal children's ability to obtain a quality education.
And we're just about out of time, but real quickly, when you say looked at further, what would you like to see happen?
Well, personally, I'd like to see the end of native mascots or racially based mascots, but you know, there really needs to be some sort of retake on that whole legislation, because, again, it's proven fact that these images are harmful to our children.
Brandon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Brandon Tomes, Public Relations Coordinator for the Chippewa Federation.
You can watch the State of the Tribes address that happened earlier today. Wisconsin Public Television will broadcast that tonight at 7 o'clock.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. What's your favorite thing about Milwaukee? What defines the city for you? There's the beer, the brewers, the buildings. But our next guest is drawing attention to one critical element that's been at the heart of the city since really before it existed, the water. Between three urban rivers and Lake Michigan, Milwaukee's freshwater resources are both highly practical for shipping, other uses, and highly visible.
And according to our next guest, there might not be another city in the country that's capitalized on its freshwater resources better than Milwaukee. In a new series, he explores the city's water history, its pioneering efforts to improve access to the water and clean it up, and he says freshwater just might be the key to the city's long-term economic success.
David Holmes joins us now. He's a Milwaukee-based environmental scientist and an urban revitalization consultant. His series, Freshwater Mecca, appears on urbanmilwaukee.com. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, we'll get into some of the details, but big picture, you paint a picture of a real gem here in Milwaukee's waterways. But do you think people are aware of it in that area, or do they just kind of take it for granted?
I think they're sort of aware of it. I think most people appreciate, you know, what a beautiful lakefront we have. But I think just sort of the revitalization is such a slow process that I think people end up being a little blind to all that we've accomplished, and also don't necessarily have the perspective on how it really compares to other cities.
Well, let's start on the waterfront of Lake Michigan in particular. You write that the lakefront landscape is beautiful, but it also is surprisingly accessible, especially when you could compare it to other cities on the Great Lakes. As you see it, how did Milwaukee get this right, and where did other cities go wrong?
Well, I think it's really been a long-term story, because I know we back to the park original planning for the parks that occurred, I think, maybe a century ago. And that was probably, I think there's a long history, but I think, you know, looking at this in more detail, and looking at old maps, I think people don't realize that how much of our waterfront was once industrial, covered with train tracks, and there was an airfield. And I think what we got right was, and there was another thing I think that was important too, I think when the city started developing freeway systems, I think a lot of these waterfront areas were sort of blighted and run down, and I think a lot of cities just grasped onto those as a good solution, get rid of the blight, and maybe put a new freeway there. And that was actually part of the plan for Milwaukee, too. We were going to have a lakefront freeway, and I've actually seen the study for it, and they showed a picture of some teenagers playing basketball under the freeway overhead, as if it was going to be an amenity. But luckily, that's one thing where Milwaukee residents woke up, and that was never built. And then I think since then, as our waterfront became available sort of through the transition of industry to those areas to other uses, almost all of it became, you know, like the Summerfest grounds, and was maintained as publicly accessible. So that that's really remarkable, and particularly when you really look at other cities. And I looked at like Cleveland and Buffalo. Those are cities where their waterfronts are completely lined with basically publicly inaccessible features such as highways and an airport and industrial facilities.
So in a way, Lake Michigan is part of the downtown almost of Milwaukee, whereas in a lot of cases there's a huge barrier where you can't get from the downtown to the shore.
Well, yeah, and I think I in one of the articles I presented just sort of the example of Waukegan's lakefront, which really is, you know, it's almost identical physiographic setting. The downtown ends on a bluff about a quarter mile from the lakefront. But in Waukegan, they have a restricted access highway. They have multiple lanes of active rail lines and then still industrial facilities. So it's, I think people don't realize that I think there's a lot of cities where what happened in Milwaukee didn't take place. Now, that's pretty exceptional.
That's the Lake Michigan side of the equation. You also talk about the rivers, the estuary, if you can define what that is. How has that played out? Is it a publicly accessible, visible, positive feature in Milwaukee?
The estuary is something really interesting that I think a lot of residents don't really, I think they don't really appreciate the significance of it. And the estuary is really the lower mile or two of the Kinnickinnick, Milwaukee, and Menominee rivers. And at the lower end of it, it basically maintains a water level about equal to Lake Michigan. So it's different from most rivers that are subject to, you know, vast seasonal changes in water level. And it's also directly connected to the lake. So you can be on a boat in the lake and come into the downtown area. So that, I think that people see in downtown, particularly on the Milwaukee River, where there's tall buildings that are built directly on the waterfront, and they sort of take it for granted. But that's really something pretty exceptional. Like if you go to St. Louis, I think the Mississippi River there varies by up to 50 feet in a season. And the waterfront there is always dominated by the threat of catastrophic flooding. So it's dominated by flood control measures. With that stable water level in Milwaukee, you can really create this very rich and intimate waterfront development.
And you make the case that Milwaukee's developing a river walk that rivals, maybe even is better than the most famous one in San Antonio that is itself a tourist attraction.
Yeah, that was interesting. I wanted to do that a little bit just to brag about Milwaukee a little bit. But I wanted to actually take a quantitative analysis of San Antonio's Riverwalk because I think it's the symbol of the city, whereas Milwaukee, I think, is becoming increasingly known, but I don't think it gets the respect it deserves. And what you find is that they're actually about the same size. I think Milwaukee's actually a little bit bigger now. But I think what really sets it aside is Milwaukee is in this authentic urban setting that's just amazing diversity. You have the port, you have the downtown high-rise buildings, you have these natural areas, these old restored industrial areas, and then this incredible river that's sort of a miracle, a natural resource. And whereas in San Antonio, we actually found that their walk is primarily on a canal that was excavated, and it's actually drained and cleaned once a year. So I think in terms of the size, I think we're already at the level comparable to San Antonio. But in terms of the authenticity and just being part of this incredible sort of natural resource with salmon and urban fishery and all these other incredible natural features, I think it's really something that in the future is going to be well known throughout the country.
Talking to David Holmes about his series on fresh water in Milwaukee, the economic opportunities surrounding it, among other things. We'll go to our callers at 800-642-1234. We've got Dale on the line in Wauwatosa. Dale, hi.
Hi. Mr. Holmes, I appreciate your perspective, and I think it's great that Milwaukee is becoming a center, kind of a water capital center. I just have a problem, though. There's thousands of gallons of untreated sewage continue to be dumped in Lake Michigan. And so you'd think that the powers to be would really try to address that. It's a little bit of a contradiction. On one hand, you know, we're a freshwater capital, but we continue to dump untreated sewage into Lake Michigan. So what would he suggest we could do to address that problem?
Dale, thanks for the call. David, you tackle the pollution and cleanup issue in your series.
Well, that's one I struggled with a little bit. I mean, in from my perspective, I think MMSD has done perhaps the best job of any sewage district in the country in addressing this type of problem. But I also, in sort of talking about the incredible restoration, I didn't want to overstate it either, because there's still a lot of work to be done. I think like the Milwaukee Riverkeeper gave grades of, I think, B-, B and C to the three urban rivers. So I think the MMSD does have something that's being planned, and I think that is this regional green infrastructure plan, which is also pretty extraordinary, where they're going to basically use sort of natural features rather than a major engineering works to try to further capture and completely eliminate combined sewer overflows. So I think they're working on it.
And you make the case that Milwaukee was ahead of the game again compared to other similar cities in making substantial cuts in untreated water runoff that gets into the lake?
That's something, too, that I think is pretty is underappreciated, is just how much earlier Milwaukee tackled these problems than some other cities. And one I looked at was like Indianapolis, where they started on a similar deep tunnel system. I think it was 2011 or 2012, which was basically about 30 years after Milwaukee. And so I think that the fact that we did that, in part we have to thank Chicago and Illinois for suing Milwaukee, but the fact that we did that, I think, really had a more profound impact on the whole revitalization process in Milwaukee. Sort of like by the time I think the urban renaissance really started taking root in Milwaukee and a lot of other cities in the late 80s, we'd already significantly tackled this water quality problem. And so I think the focus of development and revitalization in Milwaukee really took full advantage of the rivers being clean. And that may not have occurred if Milwaukee hadn't been such a leader.
We're talking with David Holmes about the past, present, and future of Milwaukee's freshwater resources. He says there might not be another city in the United States that's capitalized on its freshwater resources better than Milwaukee.
And what do you think? If you live in Milwaukee or you travel there, do you enjoy the river, spend time on Lake Michigan? Are you impressed with access to the city's waterways? And what else would you like to see Milwaukee do to capitalize on their water resources? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with environmental scientist David Holmes about Milwaukee's freshwater resources. His new series of articles, Freshwater Mecca, appeared on urbanmilwaukee.com, looks into how Milwaukee became a leading freshwater city with its rivers and lakes. You could join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you use those rivers or Lake Michigan on the Milwaukee shore? Do you appreciate the access to those resources? Do you think it improves the quality of life in Milwaukee? Give a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. David, let's talk about these resources as an economic driver in Milwaukee. Do they really make that much of a difference for the city's economic development?
I think they will in the future. That was one of the inspirations for the article series, too. Was there's been a lot of focus on a water initiative that's sort of based on business and technology that's gotten the city a lot of national or even international press over the past couple of years. And then that was thinking about that, was realizing that that really there was another initiative focused on freshwater, which was the revitalization of the rivers and the transformation of the waterfront land. And I think they're linked together, because I think that, it's the freshwater landscape that's the visually compelling part of the overall water initiative. And I think that within the combination of the Business Technology Water Initiative with this visually compelling and sort of experiential water-based urban playground, I think it's going to make a real compelling brand for the city.
Now, this is an interesting twist. A lot of the restoration efforts seem to be geared toward making the rivers and lakes as natural as possible within this urban environment. That's not always the way we thought of our rivers and lakefronts in big cities in the Midwest, is it?
Well, I think it's a really intriguing combination of natural features and definitely an urban waterfront landscape. I think they're both exciting. I mean, I think they caught a 48-inch sturgeon from the Riverwalk last year on Earth Day, which is sort of remarkable. But I think it's really, to me, I love the urban feature, which is the Riverwalk and the connection between the water and the landscape and living spaces. And I think that's and those are becoming increasingly interesting too. I think there's going to be a water plaza in the Reed Street Yards Global Water Technology Center that actually going to treat water from the Menominee Canal. And then at the New School of Freshwater Science, it's planned to have an actual spawning stream running up the front of the building that's going to use the water coming from the scientific research.
And the fish reminds me there's been an effort to make the three rivers there more navigable for fish further upstream. What has that involved?
That's something that was intriguing too, because it was realizing that the early leadership in cleaning up the river may have led to an early leadership in doing something about the dams, and so in the Milwaukee River, a big change occurred when the North Avenue Dam was removed in 1994, 1995, and I think the river went from having about 3 fish species to over 50. But then it turns out that since that time, there's been about two-thirds of the dams that were on the main stem of the Milwaukee River have either been removed or made passable to fish. And this, as far as I could tell, there's no major urban river in the United States that has been made so passable to fish. And that's really the long-term challenge, is to sort of restore the ecosystem. And there's been a lot of work done in Ozaukee County where the dam removal is the easy part. Then it turns out that every culvert under highways or stuff like that could actually block fish from getting to the actual wetland areas. So it's a very difficult, involved process. But that's another area where I believe that, in particular, the Milwaukee River, there's no urban river that's made as much progress.
I'm wondering, are other cities, say, on the Great Lakes starting to look at Milwaukee and saying, why aren't we doing that?
I don't know if that... My impression is that they haven't yet. I read a lot of urban blogs and see what people in Buffalo and Cleveland and other places are saying. And I actually haven't seen much recognition of what Milwaukee's done.
So I want to get into a to-do list before we're done. What is one change you'd still like to see happen in Milwaukee's freshwater resources to make them cleaner, more accessible, more interesting to people?
I think one change I'd like to see is sort of a perceptual change, where my sense was that we've developed all these great things along the lakefront and along the rivers over the past 2 to 3 decades, but they've all sort of been seen as unrelated attractions, you know, from the Harley Museum, the Calatrava Edition, the Riverwalk, where I think if we really saw them all as a linked freshwater landscape, as sort of an incredible whole, I think people would get more excited about it. But I think in terms of what we're doing, I think what's already underway is pretty remarkable, and that was one of the things I wrote about in the series too. I think there's there's at least $500 million of projects in the pipeline along the river for redevelopment, and an equally impressive roster of environmental restoration projects. So I think just continuing this present course.
And briefly, what does having this water around actually add to our quality of life?
I think it adds tremendously to it. I mean, I think reading about cities and, you know, sort of the whole what millennials are looking for, they want a city that has a high level of environmental quality, and they sort of want a city where they can have an experiential lifestyle. And I think that's one of the amazing things about the what's happened in Milwaukee is it actually provides both of those in one package. I mean, we have an experiential environment where you can walk, you can kayak, you can bike. Soon there's going to be a rock climbing facility on the Milwaukee River. But it's also this extraordinary environmental feature.
We'll leave it there. David Holmes, thanks for joining us. That's David Holmes, Milwaukee-based environmental scientist. His series Freshwater Mecca is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.